I don't really remember how we chose to go to Senegal, but now that we've been there, I can tell you it's a ball.
Thank you for tuning in to Hannah and Eric Go Birding, a podcast by birders for birders.
I'm Hannah and he's Eric.
And we created this podcast to share adventures, sometimes misadventures, and opinions that we have on different birding topics. We're definitely not experts in anything that we discuss that might be controversial. I want you to remember, it's our own opinions. It might be different from yours. I feel like I cut out some, like, words in that when I said it.
You think so?
Yeah, it felt like it. But anyways, I said it. We got through it. It's okay.
Yeah. And you know what? The new year is just right around the corner.
Yeah.
Are you ready for 2024?
No.
I know. We didn't do any... Didn't do any of the fun things, you know, the Christmas bird counts.
I know.
We didn't do any, you know, the None count the itself and the, like, the party afterwards. We didn't haven't really had a chance to celebrate with birders.
Yeah, that's how you finish a year, with a Christmas bird count. I know. You know the year is coming to an end because you've done your Christmas bird count.
Yes, exactly. But maybe we can do, like, a first day bird walk. What do you think?
That'll make me feel better.
Yeah. You want to do that?
Sure.
Go around the sewage ponds?
Yeah. Walk around the sewage ponds.
Okay. Well, I hope you all had a good Christmas bird count season. Of course, it's not over yet. And a
couple more days left.
Yeah, and good holidays, whatever you celebrate, if you choose to celebrate anything.
Mm-hmm.
We had some fun. We didn't get any birding stuff, really, for our holiday celebrations.
Your parents got you that stained glass...
Yes, the birds.
The bird menagerie...
Sure.
I don't know exactly what you call it, but it's hanging in our kitchen window.
It's beautiful.
It takes up like half of one of the sections of the window, like a third of the window up at the top.
My sister.
That's pretty cool.
Well, my sister did get me that that drawing that she bought from someone at a vineyard during like a art show that has an Atlantic puffin and then a vintage cocktail glass. So that's. I mean, that's pretty spot on.
It
kind of
fits in with your other podcast.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I won't talk about it.
Women Birders Happy Hour. Yeah.
So some other things that we want to mention before we get talking today is about the International Conference for Women Birders. So I know I've talked about it for years. You've heard me all mention it. And it took place in Uganda, December 6th through the 8th.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we decided not to go to it this year, but it was a hit. You know, there were a lot of people that went.
It looked fantastic. I haven't watched all of the clips that they put up on YouTube or on, I think they're through YouTube.
Yeah, I think so.
I was watching through Facebook onto YouTube, I think. So, I haven't watched all of them yet. I've watched a couple of them and there's some really good talks that were posted on there.
Yeah. Some really inspirational stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And I wish we would have been there to see it in person and get the whole vibe of the room.
But, yeah, I had some serious FOMO.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, and so I've had a chance to talk with some folks who went to it, and I'm just, like, super happy with, you know, that folks went and had a good time and learned stuff and collaborated and worked together. And unfortunately, I did hear that some folks received hate from hateful comments and things from other birders around the world, which I find disappointing. You know, I know there's a lot of politics going on in Uganda right now, and the goal of this is to help women birders, and it's unfortunate, you know, that it came at a time when there's some really hateful things going on in parts of the world. But, you know, it's a hard situation to be in, and Eric and I talked a little bit about it a couple months ago on the podcast here and told you our opinions and our feelings about it, and I don't know that we made the right decision by not going, but
the whole conference was to support women birders, and just because a government is deciding to do something stupid doesn't mean that women birders in with the already marginalized population gets to continue to be marginalized further. So it was a good conference, and I'm very happy that it was successful. I'm glad there was some Americans went. They had some people from Australia, some women from Europe, kind of all over. There was a lot of
folks from Africa,
but mostly from Africa because it's a lot easier to get to parts of Africa from Africa. But there was people from around the world that went to the conference, and that's fantastic. And I was glad to see the diversity of countries represented that were there.
Yeah, so in January, the committee is going to start talking about a 2025 conference. So I look forward to seeing where that brings us.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to participating and being a part of it, you know, on the ground. So, I'm really looking forward to it. And, you know, this has really spurred something great. It's good to know that people are interested in it and went and, you know, had a good time. And yeah, look forward to 2025 conference.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we had some folks buy us a coffee, and we just want to thank you for that. Lynn, Dale, and John, thank you so much for buying us coffee and supporting our podcast. And we're so glad that you enjoy listening. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. So our episode, our Birda bird fact of the episode today is about a little egret. It's a species that you can see in the UK. You can also see it down where we were at in Africa, Western Africa. I think all across all of Africa.
It's through sub-Saharan Africa and like parts of Asia, like east of India, and then a lot of Australia as well. There's sections in the UK, and it's really cool to look on the Birda app, and you can see the map of where all the locations are that you could potentially see them. So it's a great mapping system that they have on there.
It's and the fact that they've got for us, that Birda's got for us about little egret is really fascinating, because it kind of links, to me, in my mind, it links the U.S. to the rest of the world in terms of the fashion that was going on back in the 1800s. And the little egrets were persecuted back then for their feathers, and their feathers were more valuable than gold. So similar thing is going on here in the States with snowy egrets. Their breeding plumes being harvested is just killing them like crazy. And the same thing with little egrets. So I found that extremely fascinating. That it's like, okay, so we were all horrible to birds in the 1800s. The entire world. It wasn't just some countries. Anna's really rolling her eyes at me.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, if you want to go find a little egret, you can check on Birda on the app there to see different places where people have seen them recently. Also look at the mapping system that they have, so you can go and find a little egret on your own if you choose to.
Yeah. All right. So Hannah's got two other podcasts. Women Birders Happy Hour, we talked about with her wine glass photo that she just got for Christmas, and Bird Nerd Book Club. You had an episode come out last week and then one coming out next week. So this last week, it was Women Birders Happy Hour, right?
Yes. And I had Sarah Cunningham, who works for Birda, join me for that episode. So that was fun to talk with her. And her drink of the episode was a European shag. And then next week, I have an episode of the Bird Nerd Book Club, like Eric mentioned, and that's with Trish O'Kane, whose book, Birding to Change the World, is going to be coming out in 2024. So I'm really looking forward to chatting with her. I finished her book when we were in Africa, and it was fantastic. And I can't wait to talk to her about it.
Awesome.
So we're going on a couple trips to places.
Trips to places, yeah. So in the next, our 2024 schedule isn't really full or finalized yet, but we do know that we're going to San Diego Bird Festival in a couple of months. It's in February. It's the end of February. Super excited about that. Always love going back. Birding by bike. We're going to be doing a couple of presentations. I think we're going to be going on the Pelagic. Kind of a handful of things that we're doing around there. I think the big big excitement is the party.
Of course.
Friday night? Saturday night. The big, big exciting party at the brewery. That's awesome. Spring Chirp at the end of April. Great boutique festival. I think there's still slots open for that one as well. And then
and that's in the Rio Grande Valley.
Rio Grande Valley. And then Hannah is going to Brazil in September for the Amazon Burning Expedition Brazil for women.
And I believe there's one more space available.
One spot.
If anybody wants to join me in Brazil.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So our Bird Nerd giveaway, the deadline for that was Christmas Day, December 25th, and people were submitting their favorite cold weather adaptation of birds, and the randomly selected winner would win a prize pack of bird books that was given to us by a publishing company, and that includes a collection of field guides about owls and woodpeckers and finches and more. So Eric, would you like to announce our winner?
Yeah, so the winner, we've got Laura, who sent us all about a really in-depth description of, was it countercurrent heat exchange?
Well, it's duct circulatory system adaptations.
Yeah, so it's fantastic. So I'll read the whole post from Laura here real quick. So I learned that ducks have a circulatory system adaptation for enduring cold weather and for swimming in cold water. Their legs and feet circulate blood somewhat separately from their circulatory system that supports the rest of their body. Thus, cool blood can circulate through their legs and feet and not shock their heart or other organs by circulating through them regularly. There's also warm blood arteries that direct blood into their legs, and these are located close to the cold blood vessels to help support them with warmth and oxygen. Their upper body is kept warm by several layers of down and feathers, which traps air for warmth and buoyancy, which keeps them from soaking through to their skin even as they sit on water or dive under it. Ducks further waterproof themselves by preening, often to clean and align their feathers, coating the outer layer with oil from a uropineal gland located near their anus. Who knew all this stuff? Amazing. So, Laura, thank you so much for your submission, and thank you so much to Kolath and Stensoff's Publishing for getting us these books to give out as a prize pack, and I look forward to what we come up with.
For January.
And we'll be in touch, Laura, for getting where to send you this stuff.
So we're here today to tell you about birding in West Africa.
West Africa.
So I, like I said in my song, I can't quite remember how we landed on going to Gambia and Senegal. I think it was like I was looking at eBird, and we knew we had this time frame that we were going to travel, and I looked at eBird in December and tried to figure out where, like, the red dots were on the, you know, hotspot finder mm-hmm. that shows you where, like, the highest species count is for any given point in time.
Yeah.
And so I was just screwing around on that. And then Gambia was, like, a beacon on there.
Yeah, there was a couple random beacons in December, and we were
looking at like Nepal and Bhutan.
Yeah,
also, but those were kind of like difficult to figure out getting to.
Yeah, this seemed like the easier option to travel to based on visas, entry requirements, and also the cost of the flights.
Well, and also that it wasn't going to be cold.
Yeah,
it was easy to find a guide.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of factors that
It was a lot. It was a bunch of stuff put together, and it essentially kind of highlighted how us coming up with this trip was essentially highlighted how we travel in general. Of we have a general idea that we want to go somewhere we haven't been.
I wanted to go to Africa.
We have a general idea of a time frame, not really set in stone, and then from there, we just start looking for where cheap flights are, where we can easily find a guide to the location, and then where we think we're going to be comfortable and or if it's going to be easy to get in and out of the country.
And it also doesn't...
So it's kind of like all these things put together to make the travel more fluid, but then also reduce our costs, because then we're not like set in like, oh, January 3rd, we're flying to Mexico for this one particular thing.
And it's also
more fluid.
Like, it also helps that when I looked at the top 100 for Gambia, like mm-hmm. I like didn't know any of the names on it.
That was definitely a bonus, that it's a place that we don't know really anybody that's traveled there.
Yeah.
We do now, because while we were there, somebody that we know, Katinka from ABA, she also was there at the exact same time, which we had never even thought about going here until we put this trip together, and then all of a sudden, the same time we're going, she's going there.
Yeah, that was
funny.
It's
like, this is the weirdest coincidence ever. And then one person from our town is from Senegal. Is from Senegal.
But he's not a birder.
He's not a birder, no. He's just somebody that happens to live near us right now.
Yeah, so there's four people in all of Cana Beach that have been to Senegal.
Us, our friend from Senegal, and then his wife who traveled to Senegal and met him down there.
Yeah. So anyways, We made the plans, arranged for a guide, and we were off to Gambia, was mm-hmm. where we were flying in and out of. The main airport there is Banjul, which is, I don't know, maybe 45 minutes or so from the ocean.
Yeah. It's not actually in Banjul, which is interesting. Which I guess there's a handful of airports around the world that are like that, where it's like it's called the Banjul Airport, but it's like an hour away from Banjul, or 45 minutes away from Banjul.
Yeah, so after a brief 25-hour flight to get there.
Very brief, yeah.
So our flight path, we did have to transfer twice, which we don't really like doing so much. But, you know, to get to some places, sometimes you have to do that.
Yeah.
So we left from Portland International mm-hmm. Airport, flew to Chicago, and then Brussels. And from Brussels, we got to Banjul from there.
Yeah.
So it is a lot easier if you're traveling from Europe to get there, because it's, you know, honestly, we talked about this a lot. Like, why are people going to this destination? Because, like, we're interested in tourism itself. Or at least I'm really interested in, like, the sociology of tourism and the science behind it, and leisure mm-hmm. studies and stuff like that. And so I was trying to figure out, like, the whole time we were there, like, what makes people travel here?
Yeah, so we ended up meeting people throughout the trip that were from Belgium and
the Netherlands
and Germany, Denmark. And so that was, like, one of the first questions for them every single time. And it really seemed like it's easy.
Yeah.
It's easy to come down. They're,
it's like a six-hour flight.
England has a direct flight, Amsterdam has a direct flight, and Brussels has a direct flight to Banjul or to Dakar.
Yeah.
So very, very, very easy flights if you live near one of those three airports or you live in Europe. Very easy to get to there. It's warm in the winter. There's a pretty large variety of wildlife, and it's relatively inexpensive to be there. The hotels, the food, all that stuff. So it kind of seemed like, not that we'd ever really thought about it, but for Europeans, kind of a no-brainer to just fly down. Really easy entry into Africa.
Yeah, and so we were trying to liken it in our mind to, like, America, and we kind of figured it's like going to Mexico. And it's like how a lot of,
similar, yeah.
Like how a lot of Americans will go down to Mexico for, like, Christmas or, you know, a vacation in the winter because it's warm, it's,
yeah.
You know, inexpensive, and there's a lot of things to do there. And so that seemed to kind of be the same idea with going to Senegal and Gambia for a lot of these Europeans, like Eric mentioned.
It kind of seemed the general consensus that we were getting from the people we were talking to there.
Yeah, that might not be exactly accurate, but that's kind of what we gathered from conversations with folks.
Yeah.
So anyways, we got down there. Our guide, Abrima, who we found online, he had planned on picking us up, which was fantastic because I didn't want to have to figure out getting a taxi. But also,
turns out a taxi wouldn't have been that complicated,
yeah,
anyways.
It would have been.
But it puts you really at ease if you know that right when you land, you're going to have your guide pick you up at the airport.
And it was nice to meet him, you know, before we got into a 2-week thing.
Not that we could have can't. It would have been stupid or a jerk move to cancel then.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, we don't like you. Let's do something else.
Yeah.
No, but.
But just before getting to where Brima picked us up, getting into the airport. It's a rather small airport. I mean, what do you think?
I think it's got it might have two runways. It's either one or,
like,
two runways.
It was kind of like McAllen or Harlan.
Well, yeah.
It was smaller than Harlingen.
Smaller than Harlingen. It's maybe two runways. I think either one or two runways and technically four gates, but really not. It's just one gate.
Yeah.
It's there's four doors that go outside. And they're listed 1, 2, 3, and 4 for the gates, but it's just four doors that go outside. There's no different place that you go.
Anyways, so if you decide to make this trek for yourself, when you get there, they shuttle you over to, like, a tourist fee, which is, like, a security fee.
Oh, there's a security fee, and then
hang on. Yeah, hang on. So the security fee was $20.
Yes.
And it was $20 American, and we didn't have any American money, or we didn't have, you know, $40 for the two of us, because we just didn't carry any American money with us.
Mm-hmm.
Our guide suggested we brought British sterling pounds, because that's what they use a lot in Gambia, since it was an English colony.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a lot of pounds with us. So we did use pounds to pay for the security fee. They did give us change, which I appreciated.
Yeah.
And then they took us to, like, the passport control.
Yep, passport control.
And they separated us, and the guy was asking me a lot of questions about, like, do you have your visa? What are you doing here? You know, all those kind of things. And we...
All the regular questions they ask at passport control.
But we hadn't looked into getting a visa, because when we initially booked the trip, we were looking on the U.S., you know, the U.S. State website.
Yeah.
And it said, like, you can get a visa when you get there. And so I was like, okay, we'll just get visas when we get there. Not a big deal.
Yeah, and visa upon entry. That was the number one thing. I was like, okay. And that's like 50% of countries are, like, that
for
we've
Americans,
been to for Americans are visa upon entry. You just pay a fee when you get there, and then you get a visa. Or sometimes you don't even have to pay a fee. Sometimes it's just tell them where you're going, and then they just stamp your passport and give you a visa.
Yeah. So we didn't get visas in advance. So they took us to, like, a back office and had us fill out some paperwork. And then it was another $120 each to pay for the visa.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't take credit cards. So we had to, you know, figure out that with the British sterling pounds, because it was 120 US.
Yeah.
So anyways, that was complicated.
And no change on that in that transaction.
Yeah. We didn't get any change there.
Yeah.
So anyways, got out, you know, had all our stuff, so it was fine. And
we did know about the $120 ahead of time.
I just, like,
I read that online. I read that on the State Department website that $120 per person on, if you do the visa in person,
mm-hmm.
did not say anything about the security fee.
Yeah.
That wasn't anywhere online.
Oh, see, I did see that online.
Oh, I didn't see that part. I saw the visa. I did not see the security fee. And there's also a visa or a security fee, I mean, on exit as well. So be prepared for that.
Yes.
You have to pay that. Otherwise, they will not let you into the airport to catch a flight.
Yeah. So anyways, moral of the story there is bring cash and, you know, just try to give exact cash.
Yes.
So anyways.
Apparently USD.
Yeah. So Abrima took us to our hotel, mm-hmm. which was for that night, which we had booked with the Senegambia Beach Resort because, you know, that just sounded lovely to
sounded
me.
Nice.
Yeah. And I was able to book it through points, which was really handy. And
it was nice.
It was very nice. It's a nice big hotel. A lot of European guests there. It seems like a lot of Europeans come down and, you know, just enjoy the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And which was also lovely. Had a couple great birds just from the hotel gardens right there. Had a yeah. Western plantain eater, which was a lifer. We'd had Eastern plantain eaters, and I was just thinking plantain eater in my head. And so I was surprised it was a lifer.
I know. I hadn't even thought about it being two different species, a Western and Eastern.
It's yeah.
like a plantain eater. I yeah. just saw it and just spouted it off. Didn't even really give it two thoughts. And then when I entered the checklist, I was like, oh, wait a minute. We haven't seen a Western before.
yeah, so found some dinner, had a couple beers, chilled out, and then spent the night there, got up early the next mm-hmm. morning and met up with our guide.
Yeah, so we day one was not really any birding in Gambia. So this episode is all going to be about Senegal because that's where our first half of our trip was at Senegal. So loaded up all of our stuff with Abrima, paid him the remainder of the fee that we owed him, and then we got on the road to the ferry that leaves out of Banjul itself and crosses across the river to Bara, I think is the name of the city that's on the north side, or the village that's on the north side of the river mouth. Mm-hmm. Really interesting ferry. They really pack those things to the gills with first vehicles. They start off with the largest vehicles, then they filter in smaller vehicles, then they squeeze in the motorcycles, then the bicycles and the mopeds. And then the flood of people that are on foot come on, and it's shoulder to shoulder.
There's no getting out of the car.
There's no, you don't get out of the car. You fold your mirrors in because there's going to be people standing against your vehicle the entire time.
Well, and walking past you to like sell, you know, water and
yeah,
and
water and fruits and stuff. And it's just like, it is as packed as you can imagine. Yeah, I can't even. It's hard to describe how close, zero personal space. That's
yeah.
And that was a lot of things in cities in Senegal were like this. Zero personal space. People are just crammed in. They're going about their day doing their thing, but very close to each other. Everything's very, very close. And it's also very hot. So I'm sweating the whole time.
I know.
And I'm feeling bad that I'm getting like sweat on people. But that's just everyone's super close together. So that's the same way this ferry was. We were just crammed together. Handful of birds across the channel, but not really anything
I couldn't
super
really see
unique.
Anything.
There was a whimbrel right as we pulled out. There was a heron right at the dock, but
a reef heron.
Yeah. But nothing really like stood out as super, super amazing. So got across, made our way in, and went across one of the most confusing border crossings I think we've ever done between Gambia and Senegal. So getting from Gambia to Senegal, no additional fees. There was no money exchange.
Yeah.
But
you have to go through like three lines.
You have to go through like these three different lines, and there's no signs for anything. It's just you. I think it's a daily crossing thing. Like people just come across back and forth. So then 99% of people crossing don't need signs. They
yeah.
know they need to go here, get this, and then go over there and get that. And that's it. But for us, traveling across, first time ever traveling across, we don't have paperwork for crossing. It's just getting a short-term tourist visa, tourist mm-hmm. transfer across, is very confusing. We had to stand in one line, and then we got out of that line, and then they were, and in Senegal, they speak French. It's all French, or very close to all French, Wolof and French mixed together. And then they never give us any direction about which line to go next, and then Abrima, our guide, was like, oh no, you have to go over here.
I know.
So we go over there, and then as soon as we finished there, they didn't tell us anything at all, and he's like, now you have to go to the back room of this building over here. So then we go over to the back room of this building and they give us a stamp for the passport.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been able to figure it out if it wasn't for Brima.
But then they never checked. They never again checked anything. once we went in, we were in, and they never checked anything.
Well, they had to check his car a number of times, and he had to get paperwork.
He had to get a lot of paperwork for his car.
And then they, like, we went over to the other side, and then there was somebody that had to, like, do an inspection on his car.
Popped open the hood, did a whole inspection of his car. It was a whole thing, which was interesting, because then we started driving through Senegal.
And there was another one.
And it was just, like, constantly getting checked. His car was getting checked, and the whole 7 days we were there, his car was getting checked, and paying a lot of bribes, honestly, to police officers, because they would pull him over and be like, oh, well, I'm just going to take your car. Give me some money or I'm taking your car. And then he'd give him money and then we'd go on our way. But it was really, really interesting.
Not that I ever felt like we were in danger at all.
No, because Ibrahima was just paying, he would just be like, he would fight with him a little bit, and then he would pay the fee is what they called him. And then the guy would just kind of like flip through the paperwork and hand his paperwork back.
So anyways, got through all that and then got to our first night in Senegal, which was at this beautiful resort called Toubacouta.
Mm-hmm.
And it overlooked, you know, the Senegal.
Near the village of Toubacouta.
Yeah. So it overlooked a river. And that was our plan for the evening, was to go out on that river, do a boat ride.
Mm-hmm.
And our goal was to look for the white-crested tiger heron.
Yeah, so we go out in, this is probably one of the bigger boats that we went on the whole trip. We went on a lot of boats on this, trip. Almost every single day we were in a boat of some sort, either a canoe or sometimes a little bit larger boat like this boat that could fit like 15 people. But it was pretty much every single day we were in a boat. And very rarely was the boat not currently sinking while we were in it.
That's just what boats do.
I guess that's the way boats are. They're always sinking.
Yeah.
You're just always trying to make them not sink by shoveling water out of them. But we traveled, beautiful river. Saw our first baobab trees along the shores of this river, or this tidal inlet that we were in. And great, great species. Ibis, osprey,
Goliath herons.
Over 30 species of birds, just... Great evening on the water.
Bedouin snake eagle, I think.
Yeah, was that a lifer? Yeah, that was a lifer then.
Yeah, a lot of kingfishers too, of course. Mm-hmm. Bee eaters. I love bee eaters. They're like just a reason to go to some of these places.
Oh my gosh, I know.
Just to see the bee eaters.
There's so many different species of bee eaters too.
I know.
Yeah, so we went along and we stared intently at the shores.
Looking for that tiger
heron. 2 hours or so, hour and a half. And no tiger heron. Unfortunately, we did not get the white-crested tiger. Did not find, but, you know, you don't find every bird you look for.
But that was just absolutely a beautiful resort.
Gorgeous, yeah.
And so, so peaceful, too. Mm-hmm. So the next day was our day to go look for a very cool bird that a lot of people go specifically to Senegal to look for, the scissor-tail kites.
Yeah.
And so we loaded up in our van and did a couple, you know, did some birding on the way out of Toubacouta.
Yeah.
And then
we just did some stuff right near Toubacouta. So we got some, it was kind of like this weird quarry area almost. Got some really good pictures and recordings of African gray hornbill. Lots and lots of birds. Rufous crowned rollers were lifers. Chestnut backed sparrow lark. Violettes barbette. Got recordings and photos and just great looks at these birds. Lots of really, really confiding little bee eaters that were just like hanging out. Hannah got a bunch of videos and pictures on phone scoping with those guys. Then we kind of moved from there, started heading north towards our destination, which was Kaolack, or right near Kaolack is where the scissor-tail roost is at. So we start heading north, and this day kind of lined out the way the rest of Senegal was going to go, of not really birding hotspots. They're just kind of driving along, and there's, this road. Somebody one time saw a northern puffback down this road. Mm-hmm. And so we'd stop, or we'd get out, we'd walk down this road about a mile, like this dusty road about a mile, and we'd end up with 50 species of birds of just walking down this road. And then we'd get back in the van and drive for another 45 minutes to an hour. And then there'd be another spot. You'd be like, yellow-crowned gonolex are really common here. So let's hop out here. And we'd see some really cool birds, but it wasn't really any like hotspot, not like we're going to a national park or a bird location that has signage or anything. It was just places on the side of the road, and we just walked down, and some of them had really good habitat once you got really far off the road. Some of them were just kind of farm areas, but we got some really good birds just like randomly on the side of the road going. So our guide, we learned something new. We're constantly learning something new from Ibrima because we just met him. But he does a really good whistling imitation of a pearl-spotted owlet, which if you live in the U.S., a lot of guides will be really good at imitating eastern screech owls or northern pygmy owls or just different owls.
Some of these really aggressive owls that will go after little birds.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so what they do is they do that call, and then that attracts a mob of birds to seek out that possible predator.
And then you, all of a sudden you have a whole flock of birds to look at. And it's kind of an interesting way. I'm not as opposed to doing that as playing callback, because it takes quite a bit of skill and practice to actually whistle good enough to sound like to fool the birds that are gonna mob.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're just like pushing a button on a recorder and just like harassing birds. You actually have to whistle, and you have to practice and get better at it. And Ibrima is really good at the pearl spotted owlet, and does a really good job of arousing a mob of birds. And he did that a number of different times. He'd whistle it, do like four or five iterations. And there was one of them he actually ended up whistling in a pearl-spotted owl, where he's whistling it, and then the birds are mobbing, and then a pearl-spotted owlet comes in and starts whistling back, and he's like, okay, I'm done whistling now. Now he's going to start creating a mob around him.
Yeah.
And so then that owlet was whistling and hopping around and trying to investigate, and then all the birds are investigating the owlet, so it was a whole thing. But we worked our way north as we were going along, and made it to a village that's just to the south and to the west of the city of Kaloc. Mm-hmm. And Kaloc's a fairly large city in southern Senegal, southwestern Senegal. Southwestern-ish? I don't know. Senegal's like split in half by Gambia, so it's hard. Is it southern
it's
Senegal still?
Southwestern of the northern section.
Of the northern section of Senegal.
Yeah, so we got there, we picked up the local guide who was there, and drove out towards the river that we were going to cross to go see the scissor-tailed kites. And first off, though, we parked in the middle of what seemed like nowhere.
Just a field.
Yeah, a field, which is, like Eric mentioned, that's much of the places that we were birding, were just these random, like, kind of cow pasture fields. It's like rangeland out in, like, eastern Oregon.
Yeah, exactly. BLM land or stuff like that here in the States that you'd see, like, in the western U.S., like in eastern Oregon or northern California, Nevada,
well,
Utah.
Not hilly.
Just like nothing. Just prairie grass and just nothing. And it's this type of habitat, this region of Africa called the Sahel. And it's the in-between tropical Africa and the Sahara. Mm-hmm. It's basically this transition period, or this transition section of Africa that's kind of wet, but also very very seasonally wet.
Yeah.
And it does get a lot of rain.
Well, and we were in the dry season.
And we're in the dry season, so everything's dry.
Yeah.
So it's a very prairie-like habitat that is very reminiscent of what you would see in, like I said, in Oregon, California, Utah, like the whole prairie area.
And that's basically what we were in for most of Senegal. Mm-hmm. We did go to like a couple deltas that we'll talk about, but yeah, that whole section, like, it was weird because we went to one area and we didn't see any cows, but there were cow droppings, like
cow pies everywhere.
Every like 5 feet there was one. Mm-hmm. It was so odd. And you know, it's because that area is so heavily populated. Like Senegal is, I looked it up the other day, it's about the same size as South Dakota, and there's 18 million people that live in that space, and there's definitely not 18 million people that live in South Dakota.
Yeah, it's
I think it's closer to like 4 million is what I think I looked up. But it's so
people are spread even, they very are evenly spread, because you have three like population centers: St. Louis, Dakar, and like Kaloc, mm-hmm. are like three population centers, and then everyone else is spread very uniformly across the entire landscape in villages.
Yeah.
That are spaced like a mile apart or 2 miles apart.
Just I know.
The entire country.
The whole time you're driving like through these areas. We didn't get to eastern Senegal, so we don't have a good gauge on that. But at least in western Senegal, like on these main roads that we were on, every mile there was like a village, mm-hmm. and you know, every 10, 15 miles there was like a bigger village.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it's just, it's really interesting to go through that area and see how densely populated it is, because like here in Oregon, you know, you drive like an hour.
Once you leave the population center.
Yeah. You can drive like hours without seeing people.
Exactly. But not the case in Senegal.
Yeah. Cause we were like walking through the wilderness and we'd like run into like some people herding cows.
Yeah, a group of kids that are herding cows.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay, well. I thought we were in the middle of nowhere right now, but we are not. We are very near a village.
So anyways, we got to Kaloc and, like I said, picked up a local guide. And then we went out to this field to look for Seville's bustard just before sunset, because everything is timed really well. And that's one of the things I love about guides is that, you know, they have things timed. Mm-hmm. And so he knew what time we needed to get to the Scissortail fly kites. And so we had time to look for the Seville's bustard in advance of that. So we all spread out in this field, you know, like 100 feet apart from each other, mm-hmm. and just wandered through and then kind of did a sweep back towards the vehicle when it finally
it just shot up out of the brush. And like we didn't even really get that close to it from where it shot up. We were probably 200 feet away from it or so. And then it flew like diagonal across our line of the four or five of us that were out, mm-hmm. there. And when it landed, it was much closer to us than when it took off. So like it got confused which way it needed to fly, but then it hung out in the open. It stood in the open. I got a handful of photos of it. I think it was a little bit hard for you. I don't think you brought your scope with you.
No.
But it was kind of, it didn't spend a lot of time, maybe like 3 minutes or so, 4 minutes
in
the wide open. And then it just kind of started walking and then just was gone.
Yeah.
Just like, and this is very, very, common with bustards that they'll flush or they'll get out there and then they just kind of wander around for a little bit.
They're awkward.
And then disappear and all of a sudden they're gone. You'll never, unless you actually follow it and harass it, you won't find it again. You won't just see it while looking, which is kind of interesting.
So we loaded back in the van, drove, mm-hmm. about a quarter mile or so to park at the river's edge.
Yeah. Well, quote unquote river's edge. Okay. We were still like a quarter mile away from the creek. Like it was, and I think it's because this whole creek is tidal. It's all tidally influenced.
Even though we were so far away from the ocean.
Yeah. But we parked, Hannah and I and Abrima put on some rubber boots and, Muhammad, who is our lead Senegal guide. And then, the local guide from the village, mm-hmm. They just took off their shoes and went barefoot, which the ground was so hot. I don't know how they were able to walk across that salty, hot ground for like initially.
Yeah.
But then when we got to the mud, it was like, okay, well, that made sense.
Yeah. So like had to walk a quarter of a mile in, mm-hmm. semi mud to get to the canoe to cross. I mean like what, 200 feet or so?
Yeah. 200 feet. Barely or so. Barely anything. Canoe. Yeah.
And then
apparently he said it was like seven meters deep though.
What?
That's what he said that water at the middle of the creek is.
That's crazy.
So it was useful to have a canoe to cross it. Otherwise, we'd be swimming.
Well, and I was like, I was so hot and miserable at that point. I was like, should I bring my scope? And he was like, oh, yes, you should bring your scope.
You want your scope.
I was like, do I have to? And he's like, we'll carry it for you. So we got over to the other side, mm-hmm. and we got out into the mud. And it was like a quarter mile trek through like really through thick mud.
Yeah.
And like it was such interesting mud too. I want to read a whole description about it, but I was like trying to figure out information and I couldn't find anything, but you like crack the surface of the mud and the mud underneath was like a deep blue color.
Yeah. That's
and true. It was kind of like oily too.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really interesting. So we got through that and then there was like a dry patch and then there was like really slippery mud.
Yeah, and the first bit, that was like, it was like a foot to 18 inches deep.
Yeah.
Like, every single step was like all the way to the top of our boots.
Every single step.
And it was like, oh my gosh, this is, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
But it was good. It was a good workout. It was just sweat just pouring.
It was like, it was 100 degrees.
Yeah.
Like at 4 p.m., you know, one of the hottest parts of the day, mm-hmm. and we're trekking through this mud. And I asked him, Abrima, when we like got out of the canoe, I was like, how much further is it? Because I honestly, I was so miserable. Mm-hmm. Like I had several bottles of water, but I'm prone to heat, you know, sickness. And I was stressed out about that. And he was like, oh, it's like half an hour's walk. I was like, what? But that half an hour was getting through the mud to the tree line. And then from the tree line, it was like a 200-foot walk.
Yeah, and then we were there.
Yeah.
But we could see the tree line, and it was 3/4 of a mile
or so. It wasn't getting closer.
But it was not getting closer. Every step, it felt like it got further away. But it was just sloppy mud, and then a little bit of dry, and then super slippery, where it was like, I'm carrying my camera, binoculars, Hannah's carrying her scope and binoculars, and it's just like, I'm going to fall on this thing.
I know.
I'm going to break my camera, Hannah's going to break her scope, this is going to be a mess. No one fell. We all made it through. Bunch of slippiness, and then all of a sudden it was like solid ground. And I felt like getting down kissing the ground, that it was like solid ground finally. I'm not gonna fall on my face.
So we got to the tree line, like I said, walked in 200 feet or so, and then there was this covered area. Well, I mean, not super covered, but like we sat underneath some trees.
Yeah, I think it was a smaller baobab tree.
Yeah,
that we were just underneath the limbs of.
And they just stood us there, and they were like, look up. And there were thousands of scissortail kites.
Yeah.
They were soaring around us.
But they were so high at that point. It was, you couldn't see them with the naked eye. But if you put your binoculars up, it was kind of one of those situations where you look in the sky and you see nothing. You put your binoculars and there's like 100.
Yeah.
Right in the binocular view, no matter which direction you looked. And so it was like, oh. And then he was like, and give it 20 minutes. Give 15 or 20 minutes, they'll be down. You'll be able to see them. And sure enough, just slowly, minute by minute, a little closer. We started hearing them, like just chattering back and forth to each other. They dive bomb each other and then chatter when they do it. And
like I mentioned, you know, I'm an eBird nerd, so I really enjoy looking up stuff on eBird. And before we had gone, you know, he told us we were going to do this in an email, and I looked up scissortail kites, and there's only 556 records of it
on eBird. Yeah,
on eBird. And so I was like thinking, oh, this bird's gonna be really rare. This is like such a special place and everything. And then to go and see like thousands of them was, you know, it's a vulnerable species, but it's amazing how like a congregation of that can have such limited reporting of it.
And I get it, because the difficulty getting there, you have to know somebody in the village. You have to have a contact to cross the creek.
Yeah.
And pay it's real rather insignificant amount that we had to pay to cross.
I think you said it was like $40 each.
It was $40 total. It was like $5 each or something like that.
I thought it was $40.
No, each. It was like $30 or $40 total for all of us to go across. And the guy used to not charge for guides, and now he charges for guides. It was very confusing, but it was all in Wolof and French, so I didn't really understand most of what was happening.
Yeah.
But it really wasn't that much money to get there. It was a rather insignificant fee to cross the creek, use his canoe, or have him use his canoe to cross the creek, and then go there and see just thousands and thousands of these scissortail kites. I put 2,500 on the list. I think it might have been an underestimate. Not positive. I tried to estimate while they were still all flying.
Yeah.
But like after a whole bunch of them landed, I looked up at the sky again, and there was more in the sky that were way up high again. So there was more coming in. So I was like, and at that point, that's when I had estimated 2,500. And I was like, I'm just not going to bother trying to add to that estimate. I don't know how to correct it. I'm just 2,500. And there was lots of them. They were obviously tired too.
Yeah.
I mean, I got some really good photos of kites yawning.
That's funny.
Just like standing on the branches going, oh, it's cool.
And the sun was setting, you know, and the birds were starting to come down and down and down and like fill up the trees, like Christmas
ornaments. Like Christmas ornaments, yeah.
And we were sitting underneath the tree. It had, you know, there was a little bit of wind to cool us off and just chugging water like crazy. And it was just one of those moments in birding, you know, that's like, this is why I do this.
Yeah.
To see a spectacle like this was just absolutely incredible and something that I never really expected.
Yeah. I feel dumb that I didn't take any pictures with my phone as they were flying around. I was just taking pictures of the camera, and like, they were like, there was like full frame photos that I posted on the eBird checklist that I barely cropped the edges of. But that was it.
Yeah.
Like they were almost full frame as they're flying over the top of us, because they're so low as they fly through, and they're staring at us as they fly by, and then they go land on the branch, and it's like, oh man, this guy's, they know we're there, they see us there, but they don't care. They're just landing, and they're protected from most predators on this island and most anything else. We saw some hyena footprints, and we saw some warthog footprints while we were in the mud. Mm-hmm. But who knows how old any of those footprints were, because the mud was, it was so deep and sloppy that it could have, those footprints could have been weeks or months old.
Yeah.
But that was the only mammal activity that we could find. And it's like, okay, so generally not really any predators hanging out on this island in the middle of this tidal wetland area.
Well, and it helps that it's a roost location too. That's mm-hmm. not like their breeding area.
Oh yeah.
And so
yeah. It's not like there's babies or anything they're yeah. taking care of. They're just spending the night, every night for like 3 months there.
Yeah. So we, yeah, got our fill of that, went out to the creek because, you know, they were like, oh, you want to see it from over here too. And so went over there and didn't really see much else, but we started scanning, like this lake.
The flats. Yeah.
Yeah. And the flats, and had a bunch of flamingos, had like, what did you put? Like 700 kestrels or something?
It was 70 kestrels. I put 70 kestrels. There was probably over 100 lesser kestrels that were roosting on the mudflats also, which I thought that was interesting that they are roosting on the ground.
I know. That was weird.
As opposed to the kites that were all roosting in trees. I mean, it was different strategies, I guess, but there was tons of those kestrels on the ground, all in the mudflats.
Yeah, so we got back to the canoe, went across, much easier, you know. The way back is always easier than the way there. Which is ridiculous. But we got in the canoe and got back to the van and started driving out. And it was just after sunset. Mm-hmm. And there were long-tailed nightjars flying around the car.
Yeah. Yeah, they'd land for a second and then do a couple of loops around the car and then disappear into the wind.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
So we stayed the night over in Kao Lock, and then the next morning got up, and there was a known location of quail plovers,
mm-hmm.
and so we went to go look for those.
And no luck. So yes. That was probably the most frustrating thing that we searched for the whole trip. We searched for them this day, and then the last day...
In Senegal,
we spent almost the entire day walking through this field looking for them, and I got to be honest, I don't really care that much to walk through a field for 6 hours in the blazing sun looking for.
Well, also that field, it was a couscous field.
Yeah.
And rice also? No.
No, peanuts.
Peanuts.
Couscous and peanuts.
And couscous has these terrible seeds and goat heads.
Like, it's not an invasive because it's from there, but it's these weeds that grow within the couscous that is just...
I mean, we were just like covered in them, and it was painful. And
multiple different types of goat's head vines that are just like these seed heads that have these thorns that stick out of them, and they stick to your clothes, they stick to your socks, they stick to your legs, the bottoms of your shoes, everywhere, and they're miserable. So we spent a good chunk of time searching there, no quail plover.
And then spent a good chunk of time picking all the seeds off of us.
And a bunch of time trying to get all the seeds off of us and bloody finger stumps left trying to do that. But worked our way north because the next day we were going to do the next major birding location for our Senegal section of the trip, which was Djoudj National Park. It's a pretty significant location. It's a UNESCO heritage site that is recognized because it's pretty much the first location of fresh water that birds see as they're flying south across the Sahara Desert. So they come across the Sahara Desert, there's the Senegal River, and then Djoudj, which is this huge wetland area, which full of birds. All winter long, thousands and thousands and thousands of birds. And it's I would say that is like the place that's what makes birding in Senegal a good location to go is Djoudj.
Yeah.
Like that national park. And in general, Senegal isn't a huge country anyway, so you just go to Djoudj and you get tons and tons of birds. But we spent the night that first evening right outside of the park in these little huts that was in the village nearby. And then drove in first thing in the morning and were welcomed by well over 2,000 white-faced whistling ducks. Right at the entrance. Handful of fulvous whistling ducks and a couple flamingos. Greater flamingos just right off the bat. Hannah and I stood and got a handful of pictures of little bee eaters again. Some Senegal thickneys, common ring plovers. Things that you get, Senegal thickney not so much, but like the red shanks and marsh sandpipers and stuff that you get up in Europe. got some good photos of those guys while we waited for the park headquarters, or the person that was going to take our entry fee. Waited for them to get there, and Abrima went and paid the guy, and then we worked our way into the park.
We drove into like a lakefront that we had the lesser flamingos and greater flamingos in there. There was one marbled teal, so we got that.
Got that. And there was each of these little lakes that are in the area, these retention lakes, have a blind at them. And the blind at the first one had been overtaken by some barn owls.
Yeah, there were like five little baby barn owls.
There was like little baby barn owls that were terrified.
I know, I was hissing at us.
There was another group that was there at the same time as us that were from...
No, they were from Spain. That was the funny
thing. Spain. Yeah, they're from Spain.
We were talking to him at breakfast, and I was trying to ask him something in French, like in my very limited French that I have. I was trying to ask him a question, and then I heard them talking amongst themselves, and I was like, wait, do you speak Spanish? And they were like, well, we're from Spain. And it's like, oh, I'm much better in Spanish than French.
And then they were like, we also speak English. And it's like, oh, that's even easier.
I know, but it's like,
English is even easier than all these languages.
Let me try to use the languages I know.
Yeah, we can speak to you in Spanish, or we can speak to you in English, but French is going to be difficult, and we're not even going to try speaking in Wolof to you.
So that was very cool to just stand there and, you know, see this enormous amount of birds that were in the lake. And then we headed on into the park further to look for Arabian bustard.
Yeah, so Arabian bustard is not, it's almost been extirpated out of Senegal.
There's only six individuals at this park.
At this park, there's six known individuals. And I think they're banded. I think you can identify them in some fashion. But we did what we did for the Sevilles. We got in a big wide line, and we walked through a known area with appropriate habitat, and didn't get it.
No.
Didn't get them, so it was all right. You don't, like I said earlier, you don't always get all the birds you're looking for. It gives you a good reason to go back to places.
I mean, we tried a couple different areas, and we, you know, had bee eaters, we had the quail finches, we had some really good birds.
Lots of different waxbills. So that was interesting. We had the quail finches, which aren't waxbills, but they sure look like waxbills. Orange-cheeked waxbills and zebra waxbills. So like all of these birds that are seed eaters that are just all hanging out together in these big flocks. And then black-crowned cranes. Mm-hmm. That was cool. And I think I got some good audio. I'm not sure about the audio, but I think it's good audio.
So on the way back towards the entrance, where we were going to take our boat ride, there was a small grove, like really dried out acacia trees. Mm-hmm. And so we stopped there, walked in, and there were long-tailed nightjars just hanging out on the ground. Yep. There was like three or four of them.
To me, it felt very much like going to, in the States and down in Texas, going to Estero Llano Grande. That there's known common parakeets that they roost in these areas of the park, and you just go to those areas of the park, and you have to really look for them, but you usually find them when you go to these areas because they're known roost locations. This was a very similar thing, but it was kind of like in a completely undeveloped area, not near a trail or anything, just like a stand of acacias. And we go into the stand of acacias, and there's like five of them just hanging out. It's like, oh, they're just roosting for the day, hanging out all day long. So that was really cool. To get some photos and see them up close during the day. Well, relatively close during the day.
So, we got back in the car, and that took us out to the wetland boat access that we were going to go to. And they have these huge boats, and we actually passed a bus on the way out there full of tourists that I imagine had just gone on one of these boats. I think they did,
because that road's a dead end.
Yeah, you're right. So we were fortunate that we had the boat all to ourselves. And
it's a boat that fits like 40 people, I think.
Yeah, and Mohammed, who was with us, who was our Senegal guide, he actually does these boat tours really frequently. Mm-hmm. And so he was our guide on that.
He used to work full-time at Juge as a guide for the national park. So he was intimately familiar with this location. So he was able to give us some really in-depth information about all the birds in Juge, including our target for the boat, which was a island full of great white pelicans.
Well, I didn't know that until we got there.
Yeah, we didn't know that was the destination, but it was the destination.
Yeah, and it was a great boat ride. That was one of my absolute favorite boat rides.
Yeah, it was almost 5 miles long.
It was about an hour and a half, and we just kind of jetted, you know, up the river and stopped. Well, I mean, we were going pretty slow at some point, so we could see all the stuff in the...
It wasn't like hardcore motor, but it was putting along.
But Eurasian moorhen, African swamp hen... Black Craigs, African Chicanas. I mean, just all the like kind of waders and like, you know, swamp birds that you expect that you get there. Had a couple terns too, Caspian and Whiskered. So that was very cool. Black Stork flew over. That was a great boat ride. And then, like Eric mentioned, we get up to... Actually, we could smell them
before. We smell it over a mile away from it. We started smelling like... Something smells
bad. It smells like a seabird colony.
This is... It's not smelling great. What is going on? And then it starts getting more stronger and stronger as we're going along. And it was very clear. Like, I looked at... we were looking around, and I just happened to look at Ibrahima and Muhammad at one point, and our two guides. And... Like, you could tell on their face, like, like, it was one of those, like, we're going to get them with this smell, and they're going to be shocked when we come around the corner. And so it's like, oh, okay, this is going to be, like, a big reveal situation here in a second.
And then, boom, 5,000 great white pelicans.
Boom. Yeah, so Muhammad explained to us that there's actually 5,000 breeding pairs on this island during breeding season, and an additional 2,000 breeding pairs through the rest of the park that have been documented. So this... is like the largest great white, I don't know if it is, but it seems like the largest great white pelican colony in probably in the world. It's just this massive colony of thousands. And there was at least 5,000 on this island that day.
Like, it was ridiculous.
It was just solid, like an acre of pelicans, shoulder to shoulder, some of them standing on top of each other, just like on this island. And it was intense. There was so many pelicans. And pelicans are big. If you're not familiar with pelicans, they are very large birds. And to see that many large birds was pretty spectacular.
So we did also get to see a bird on that boat trip that was the bird that I've always wanted to see in my life.
I know.
But it wasn't doing the thing that I wanted it to do.
I know.
It was a black heron, which if you've ever watched Life of Birds with David Attenborough, he mentions them. And they're the heron that... puts their wings out over in front of their face.
Like an umbrella?
And they actually kept calling it an umbrella bird.
Yeah.
And it creates shade to try to, you know, hunt more efficiently. And we saw one, and it was, like, walking around in the back of everything, which Eric was the eagle eye that spotted that.
Yeah.
But it wasn't doing the umbrella thing.
It was just walking along. I got two photos of this bird just walking through the brush.
That's very cool. I'm so glad we saw that.
Yeah. Super cool bird.
So then we got back to the car, realized we had a low tire, and then got that fixed, fortunately, before heading off to the furthest north that we were going to go in Senegal for that trip.
Yeah, so we're working our way to our last little bit as we're working our way north, and then last known location for the next day was to hit up and try to find golden nightjars. Which is just a gorgeous, like, golden-colored nightjar.
Like, small.
A small golden-colored nightjar that has, like, these, like, iridescent flecks across its back. Mm-hmm. And it was this location that was east of Richard Toll. So, if you go all the way up to the border, we were on the border where we were at. But then you head inland following the river and go past Richard Toll and keep going about another hour and a half, 2 hours east. Following the river, and you get to this known location for, I can't remember what the name of the town was, but it was right on the border. Known location for golden nightjars, which I was very excited to see these guys, but heard them.
We saw it, like, fly.
We saw it fly. We could not re-find it, and man, did Ibrahima beat the heck out of his van trying to re-find it. So... We were in a farmer's field. We were there at sunset, kind of birding along. We walked along the whole edge of it, and we heard it call. And we had one flashlight with us, so we're trying to spotlight with the one flashlight, trying to find it's calling from over that direction. So we're walking along with the flashlight, looking, and all of a sudden it shoots up out of the bushes. And we're hearing a call this whole time. Mm-hmm. We're like, we're trying to find. And then it shoots up out of the bushes and then flies around us. And I'm following at the light and it ducks down to the ground. And I thought it landed.
It was gone.
But it must have swooped close to the ground and taken back off upwards again. Because I didn't catch it going back up. And we started walking towards where I thought it landed, where I watched it hit the ground or go to the ground. And then we get up to there and there's nothing there. And it's like, it's gone. It's gone. So then we go back, load up into the van, and then Ibrahima was like, we can't give up yet. So then he just drives through the access to the farmer's field and just like, boom, 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 it's like driving hardcore through this thing right along the edge of it. And it was just nothing.
Yeah.
we didn't see another bird, didn't hear any other birds. So it was really interesting to see the style of birding when you're birding someplace that's not regularly birded. That's not a developed birding location and isn't regularly birded. So it's not like there's a trail. It's not like us walking through an area is just as disturbing as the cows that just randomly wander through it or the farmers that are wandering through it. So it's not even, there's no trail. It's not like we're trying to avoid tamping down the soil and mm-hmm. creating bad habitat with that. It was just like a whole interesting thing. We just kind of just going wherever and just kind of wandering around. Like we were the locals that were farming, just kind of wandering around through fields and trees and stuff. It's a different way of birding for sure.
Yeah. So, yeah. Like we said, that was the northernmost point. So then we were working our way back towards Gambia mm-hmm. after that and birded around a couple roadside spots the next day.
But one more thing I wanted to talk about before we wrap up Senegal is this really interesting location that we birded that was just outside of St. Louis. St. Louis is one of the largest towns in Senegal. It was just to the just south of St. Louis. And it's this place that was started by a German guy, and it's called the Zebra Bar. And it's this really weird, mostly overland drivers go there, which if you're from Europe, you're probably really familiar with overlanders. I don't know if Americans are that familiar with it, but it's basically just off-roading. It's off-road camping.
It's off-road traveling,
really. Yeah, and it's a whole lifestyle. It's an adventure lifestyle that most of them are leaving out of Europe and then just driving down through Africa. And a lot of things like through Mauritania and Nigeria and stuff, there isn't really any roads to follow. You're just kind of going through the desert and just going along. And so then it's really like you're self-sufficient, living on your own. And this is a camp that was like a destination location for a lot of these people. It was relatively close to Dakar also. It's mm-hmm. like halfway between St. Louis and Dakar.
And it had a couple cabins, and we stayed in a cabin, mm-hmm. like different varying levels of cabin. Like, I guess ours had a shower and everything, but the guy next to us, he was like telling us about the public shower, and it's like, we have one.
Yeah, he had a fan, but no shower. We had no fan, but a shower. And then our guides had no shower, no fan.
And then people were just like dry camping, and there was a guy that was tent camping.
There was some that had hookups. Anyway, just all across every spectrum. Yeah.
It varied a lot. It was like the coolest hippie camp that I've ever been to. And we all had like dinner together because they had breakfast and dinner and all that there. And like we were all sitting at a group table. Like I thought Eric and I were going to like sit by ourselves in this other table. But the guy was like pointing us.
Like, he's like, no, you sit there. You sit there.
I was like, okay, fine, I'll sit there. And so we all kind of just like sat at the table. And there was one German man who was like really kind of leading the conversation when he found out that we spoke English. So he was like, oh, thank goodness I can speak English to somebody. And he spoke German and English, and then there was a couple...
But no other language.
And there was a couple from Switzerland next across from us, and then a Belgian couple next to us, and it was just like...
And there was one the young guy that was probably in his 20s or something from China.
Yeah.
There was also some people from France, I think, too.
It was just the most interesting experience. I mean, the owner is just super eccentric, and he came in playing a guitar. I can't remember what the song he was singing. I can't remember the song he was playing. But we all sang along, and then we had beers, and we ate chicken yassa, and it was just, like, the most interesting night I think I've ever had.
Yeah, we all had this big impromptu sing-along, and then we're all just chatting, and Hannah and I are practicing our Spanish and French, because there are some Spanish speakers there and some French and then German. But then everyone spoke English. And so I was like, okay, well, that makes it easy that everyone speaks our language.
Well, and then,
but we thought like, okay, well, let's try and do some German with you guys. Let's try to meet you halfway.
So I feel like, you know, when you and I like sit down and have dinner with folks, mm-hmm. like people are always asking us questions about like birding and travel and all this stuff. But this was like one of the times that it's like nobody asked us questions, which was perfectly fine.
Nobody
needs to ask me about birds or travel or whatever.
We talk
because
a lot
these people were the most interesting people that I've ever met.
Yeah, the guy from China, he had a cat.
He was riding a scooter.
A little moped. And he had a cat with him that he brought from China that I think he rode a scooter from China all the way through Asia, through the Middle East to Europe, and then across the Strait of Gibraltar and down through Africa. And now he was down in Senegal. And so he had this whole fascinating story, and we barely even got to talk to him because we were talking to the German guy that had a whole, every 5 years, he spends 8 months on the road. And the Swiss couple, and it was just like, these guys have so many stories to tell. We just had to absorb as much as we could, because we knew we only had one night to talk to these people. And it was like, I want to know as much as I can about your lives. What do you have going on?
I know.
This is so interesting.
And, you know, we were right on the ocean too. So it was so wonderful. Like,
yeah.
It's one of my favorite nights.
It was very pleasant. And even though we didn't have fan or AC or anything like that, we had a shower. We showered before we went to bed, and then you just open up the windows, and the wind is blowing through the little yurt-style cabin that we had.
Yeah,
it was nice and comfortable.
I would go back to Senegal to stay at that place again.
Yeah, and it's not that far from Djoudj, so you just stay there and then go to Djoudj.
Yeah,
or down to Kaolack. Because really, Senegal isn't there. There's a lot of driving. It's relatively large. It's huge compared to Gambia, but it's not big in terms of like what Americans think
it
of
takes
big
long
countries.
To get places though, because
the roads are very, very bad.
Yeah,
not very good roads, so it is a little bit slower, but it's not unreasonable to drive like across half the country in one day.
So yeah, had fantastic time there. Next day we looked for that quail plover again, dipped on that, and then headed out of Senegal into Gambia.
Yeah, so that'll be our next episode, is what we do in Gambia and kind of what our exit strategy was out of there, and then kind of a wrap up of our trip. But I had a great time in Senegal. It was definitely not what I was expecting. We barely even talked about food right now. We
just kind
of
mentioned
chicken yassa.
I didn't even talk about food. You have a baguette every morning for breakfast.
Yeah.
Like
every single day.
A good baguette too.
Yeah. Senegal was a French colony
until
relatively recently. And so there's a lot of French influence still. So bread and butter every single day. Everyone has bread and butter for breakfast. That was
sometimes an egg, not always,
but there's a lot of French. And then the other major thing to go over real quick is money.
Yeah,
you have to have West African francs.
Yeah,
the credit cards are
called CFAs.
CFA is what the abbreviation for the money is, but they just call it CFA. West African francs, CFA, however you want to say them.
Some places also took euros.
Very few, though.
Nobody place took credit cards.
No credit cards are accepted anywhere. And if they did, it was like $40 minimum.
Yeah.
In which to spend $40 in Senegal is very difficult.
They did not want Gambian Dalasi, American dollars, or British sterling pounds.
Yeah, no matter what the internet says about it, don't even try.
Yeah.
Get CFA, which you can't get in the U.S. at most banks, so you have to transfer it once you're there at an airport or at a port of entry.
Yeah.
Find a money exchange place in country to get it, because for some reason you can't get it here in the States, at least not easily. So that was kind of a complication we had for the most part. I used my credit card once while we were there, and
they very
reluctantly allowed me to use it. I spent a total of like $9, I think, or $10 on my credit card. And he was like, no, the minimum is this much CFA, which comes out to like $40. And it was like, how am I, we each had like three beers, and it was like, so that's like six beers for like $6.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how am I going to get to $40? Like I spent what I thought was a reasonable amount of money, and but it was a big fancy hotel. So make sure you have CFA.
We did.
That's the moral of that.
We did stop at a bank and take out money out of an ATM,
yes,
which is not something we typically do when we travel, because you have fees that you have to pay for that. So we usually try to avoid it and get money in advance, which, I mean, you don't always get the best exchange rate, but then you know you have that money.
Yes, you do.
Rather than trying to find an ATM in some of these places. And especially when we flew into Gambia, when we were dealing with the whole visa thing at the airport, the power went out twice in the airport.
Yeah.
And so that just, I mean, kind of goes to show you that, like, one of the reasons they probably don't have credit card machines like super frequent,
because they're probably constantly having to reset them,
exactly,
with the power going out,
which would be super frustrating and not reliable
at all in terms of getting money from people. So it's just easier to use cash.
Yep.
So make sure you bring cash, especially for Senegal. Gambia wasn't as paramount, but Senegal was. Make sure you have West African francs, SAFA, however you want to call them, because that's the only, really the only way you're going to be able to get by spending money there.
So all in all, in Senegal, we saw 202 species.
Yes.
Did you count how many lifers you got in Senegal?
I did not count how many lifers were in Senegal. I think it was like 60.
But, you know, if you are going and you haven't been to Africa before, if you haven't been to Europe, it's, you know, easy to get to. It's relatively inexpensive and you can get 202 species.
202 species, which for somebody that hasn't been to Europe or Africa, we counted it up. We had 20 crossover.
No, we had 15.
15 crossover species that you could get
in the Americas.
In the Americas. That are over there.
Like
so,
barn swallow and, you know, green-winged teal.
Barn owl, like green-winged teal, the fulvous whistling duck. Yeah. They're a handful of things, but 15 species. So of the 202, you're still talking 180 lifers.
Yeah.
So it's still, you can, if you've never been to Africa, you've never been to Europe, you can still get a pretty significant amount of lifers in Senegal in a relatively short amount of time. We were there for 7 days, 6 days of birding. I would really call it 5 days because we had 2 days on the quail plover.
Yeah.
But really five days of really good birding, mm-hmm. and 200 species. So yeah. pretty good. I'm looking forward to talking all about Gambia in a couple of weeks. Thank you all for listening to this podcast. We hope you enjoyed it and or learned something new. Please, please, please rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Music, or anywhere else you listen to us. If you would like to connect with us on the socials, please follow us at Hannah Goes Birding and Eric Goes Birding on Instagram. You can follow our Facebook page at Hannah and Eric Go Birding. Email us at hannahandericgobirding@gmail.com, our Twitter at WeGoBirding, our TikTok at hannahandericgobirding. Really, Hannah and Eric Go Birding gets any of the socials anywhere. Check out our website at www.gobirdingpodcast.com. Tell us what you like, tell us what you hate, and share us with your friends.